for the kind of, and also thanks to Patrick and Amy and everybody else who put this together. I think it's worked out really well. I did is made it a collective effort rather than something else, which is very useful to learn something from all the papers that I've read from today, so I appreciate it. So when they first pitched this to me, you know, it was kind of, the topic was open, something on Kentucky, and of course, you know, I've worked a lot on the Irish, and, you know, tried to move away from it, but it's Michael Corleone and the Godfather Trades, they keep following me back. particularly because in my study of the Irish in the Civil War period, I've written a book on the Irish and the Confederacy, and Susanna Euros wrote a great book on, and there's others on the Irish on the Union side. We kind of avoid the border states in general because of the ambiguities that it provides. So this gave me a chance to look into this. And particularly in the context of Christian Cimino's book of Becoming American Under Fire, where he looks at Irish Americans, a legal historian, and African American, and how the act of soldiering and taking part in the Union War effort kind of sealed efforts towards full equality or full citizenship rights, which the Irish didn't have. Before that point, particularly dealing with the Noma thing episode of the 1850s. So kind of that's the angle I took it. Here's my chance to look at Kentucky and try and deal with some of those ambiguities, things are not so simple. Also, I think in terms of looking, I say this with all my work, because I looked at the English in America as well as the Irish in America, that when you look at immigrant groups and how they try to fit in or integrate or find new lives for themselves in the United States or anywhere, they can often tell you a lot about Native societies as well, because they have to figure out things that Natives take for granted of what it means to be Southern or be Kentuckian or be American. The immigrants have to figure out, as you know, when I moved to Starkville in 1991 and opened the Yellow Pages, and there was four pages of churches in there and only four pubs in the whole town, I knew I was somewhere different than where I left. So, you know, my own personal experience here, trying to figure out what it meant, and, you know, and everything had to say, like, gosh darn it, instead of, you know, the normal thing you would say. when you're in the grocery store, you can find something. So that's kind of where I'm going with it. Maybe from this looking at the Irish and their experience of Civil War in Kentucky, we can learn a lot about Kentucky itself in the war period. Now, the context of Kentucky is also interesting, in fact, that it had a very kind of bad Know-Nothing Native experience in the 1850s, and perhaps I mean, the most spectacular example of violence against Irish Americans happened in Louisville in August 1855. Bloody Monday, with a historic plaque on Main Street in Kentucky, in the Irish neighborhood, where in a dispute on election day between Know-Nothings and the Irish Americans in particular, but also Germans, Quinn's row, an Irish tenement, was set on fire, and as people tried to escape from it, including Quinn himself and men and women, they were shot, or so they either burned to death or were shot, and we made national news. So what was the context of the Irish in when it came to the secession crisis and the war itself? So what I try to look for is examples of that. The paper I did for today focuses mainly on the civilian side. There is the soldier side, which Leslie's talked about, and I need to look at those kind of military records, because I look at that from when I looked at the Confederacy, and I've done statistics on desertion rates and people who took the oath and that. So I need to look at that side. But for today, I'm particularly the governor's papers are what was the home front like? Because with Irish Americans, often examples of bravery in the Irish stereotype of the fighting Irish played a lot in the Confederacy and on the Union side, so could be undermined by what happened on the home front. The classic example of that, of course, is the famous Irish Brigade in Fredericksburg, destroyed in Fredericksburg, great Irish bravery. And then you have the New York City draft riots, which are blamed on the Irish in 1863. It seems to undermine the whole idea of Irish being pro-Union and for it. And it means the issue I have with Christian Cimino's book, he focuses a bit too much on the military side, but forget that on the home front, this idea of Irish is fully American is undermined by the home front. And so we look at the home front here. And what you find is, I found the odd example of people trying to become American on fire. I mean, the classic case I have is a very rich story in the records is the story of Michael Foley, who's an Irish railroad worker in Lebanon in the L&M, just south of Louisville. Some guerrillas come through and basically go up to these group of Irish railroad workers and ask them if they're Union men. And he figures out that these guys are guerrillas. He's not too sure where they are because, you know, they're dressed in calico shirts, they had pistol belts and scabbards girdled around them. And also, they were riding quote unquote rebel saddle, which I don't have to look up what rebel saddle is a version of the McClellan saddle. but often kind of done on the cheap. Instead of having a leather skirt, you have a calico skirt because he couldn't afford leather. So he figured out these guys are guerrillas. They come up and ask him, they're Union men, they're Union men, what's your response? They take off, and he decides that they are guerrillas, and I'm going to go chase them and arrest them. And in the process of gathering a friend to go with him, in the process of arresting these brothers, actually, they were called the Dickon brothers, he ends up killing one of them, and they arrest the other. They end up shooting one of them in the kind of dispute, but they refuse to come with him. But he's imprisoned and charged with manslaughter. So basically, it's a petition for him to be released on clemency grounds. That these were guerrillas, and he was doing the right thing around it. Governor Bramlett, this is in 1864, who in fact was a prominent know-nothing in the 1850s. But he, you know, when he hears the story, when he reads the letters, and it's backed up also by the Provost Union Provost Marshal, so that there is the kind of military backing of the story there. He issues him a pardon and describes him as actually, you know, he's to be commended, not condemned for this. And he shows great patriotism. Doesn't mention his Irishness at all, actually, but that he's kind of a patriotic Kentucky. So he was a classic example of an Irishman, an Irish laborer, who didn't have to do what he did. He could have, it was kind of something foolhardy to go chase these guys with their sabers and their pistols. But he goes and does it. But also then, you know, I found another example on the other side of this is in 1861, in the summer of 1861, when Kentucky is like, what do we do? It's after Fort Sumter. Of somebody going to a magistrate in Louisville and saying, yeah, there's a neighbor of mine, and he says he's going to leave and join the Confederate Army. His name is P.E. Kelly. Luckily, the second initial helped me find him in the census in the Confederate Army. Patrick Kelly, 27-year-old laborer, no family. And he does, actually. He ends up in Natchez. He finds his way down the river, joins the Mississippi Regiment, 44th Mississippi, fights at the Battle of Shiloh, and then she joins another regiment in Louisiana. And this is where what made this guy do that? Well, he's a laborer. I don't know. I couldn't find any connections to the South. He's in Louisville. Louisville become prosperous in some ways during the war with all the Union supplies and all the Union soldiers moving through. Why would he take it upon himself to go south and join the Confederate forces? But these were actually rare. It's most of the examples you find in the government records. And you can find Irish sometimes they're described as Ireland, and usually it's used as a mitigating circumstance. I retitled my paper, "An Unfortunate Son of Ireland," because one of the lawyers said, you know, it's a chap who was charged, McGinney is his name, with stealing. And he said, well, actually, it was his missus do it. But you know, these Irish are kind of, they're unfortunate, you know, it's kind of inherent. The criminality and the drinking, it's just kind of part of what they are. It even showed up in Foley, that the hero Foley's one, like, well, you know, with his kind of, the temper of his race, he might have shot Dickon, you know, before he should have been shot, but, you know, he was still patriotic. So you kind of have these stereotypes, it's kind of essentializing of the Irish, but kind of used also in some ways to kind of defend them. But in general, they seem to be just causing a lot of trouble. And then also, you can go through and just use last names. For my work on Irish Confederates, I used a project that was done in Britain on isonomies, so I was basically trying to match up names with ethnicity, particularly for Irish names, because in the census in Britain, Irishness or religion, for example, was not recognized, was not recorded until about 1901. So the 19th century historians are trying to figure out who were Irish Catholics, and there's been a project done with social scientists taking an old kind of early modern land evaluation in Ireland and matching it up with the census and finding names in parts of Ireland that are more Catholic than Protestant. So I've used that using my Confederate work, and I'm using it here as well to try and find people who are probably Irish, and then you try and match them up in the census. Sometimes that's difficult. Or Irish American along the way. And then to say in general, they seem to be causing trouble, running houses of disorder, tippling. So I appreciate this, you know, they're the ones that are often selling a lot of the liquor to their friends, to other workers, and to African Americans as well. Which I found in the South, there's a lot of the kind of racial laws the Irish didn't know about, and were constantly breaking and fraternizing with African Americans, whether slave or free. So just to kind of sum up, I learned from all this stuff. I'm hoping to count them and give you some statistics around. I'm still kind of working through them, and I have some cases that I mentioned in my papers. Is first of all, that it's interesting that these petitions that come in are often accompanied with appeals for clemency, is that along with your kind of Irish neighbors, that people are also reaching out across the kind of the nativist divide. So you see a lot of, and again, justices of the peace, it's your sheriff sometimes, looking for remittance of fines. And Luther was right, you know, $50 fine, a $30 fine is a month's wage, it's basically for an Irish labor. $50 minus 6 weeks' wages, so I mean, people would be in trouble if they couldn't pay and they talk about that. So it's interesting that a place that was so native as Louisville in particular, but there seems to be a lot. There seems to, the war seems to kind of maybe ease those tensions. The other thing is that these are poor folk, and it's only this why these records are great, and I encourage everybody to use them. Is that wars kind of bring the poorer folk and the government together because they want to keep a close mind because they're undermining the war effort. I know one Irish labourer is in trouble because Owen Conway, because he's giving drink to his friends, he's going to tip the chap out of his house. But they're railroad workers. So again, you're kind of undermining the war effort in terms of moving stuff south on the end of the railroad to supply the Union armies in the west. But they're going to attorneys. So they're managing to go to their neighbours. These kind of poor, often illiterate Irish that we think in some historians like Kirby Miller have described as kind of like almost pre-modern people. They're actually quite sophisticated in terms of figuring out how to use attorneys and lawyers and use the proper rhetoric. And even the ones around when they fraternize or sell liquor to African Americans is, I there's one woman who basically says, I lived in Iowa, so when I didn't know you couldn't sell liquor to slaves. So I didn't know anything about that. Or they learn the rules that they cut in the grass. He's I think, an Irishman, and basically says, well, the owner knew this, and I was going to pay him with liquor when I hired him to cut the grass. So they're understanding the rules of kind of playing with them, which is interesting. The other thing is, the ambiguities of which side they're on. I think for most white Kentuckians, and part of it were caught up in the guerrilla warfare around here and in the Lexington area, the Bluegrass area. Most of the Irish live in Louisville or in Covington. The kind of combat and the conflict of the war kind of passes them by. And I think Bill Freeman says maybe 75% of white Kentuckians are relatively sort that out, or it's somewhere between 70 and 75, it might be 20, I think Ed Marshall says 29% served, so over three quarters. Well, in the South, it's the majority will have to serve eventually. Even northern states, it runs around 50% of people who volunteer. So, like, maybe they're trying to fit in with Kentucky in the sense of, we're going to sit this one out and do the best we can in selling liquor to Union soldiers or doing our best along the way. So it kind of brings out those ambiguities that are Kentuckian, but we see Irish immigrants reflecting that. And then I'm just wondering, in terms of becoming, which I found with Irish Confederates, and the same is true with the Irish Union on the Union side, was that for all the great stories of combat, they were ambiguous, right? The Irish in the South deserted more, took the oath of allegiance more, accepted occupation pretty well. Former Confederates joined white Union regiments in New Orleans, for example. Ken Butler, business is back. It's great. Their board's reopened again. We don't really care. Even though I was an ardent Confederate just, a month ago. And in the North, of course, as well, they're undermined by the draft right. So it's in commemoration and memory. The cliche that the American Colder talked about, that Kentucky seceded after 1865, after the Civil War, and then Murphy showed how they created that, and I found that. So maybe there is something to that story that we'll figure out how the Irish became Kentucky, was how to negotiate this kind of commemoration and memory of the war afterwards. And I'll stop there.
Great, thank you.